Imagine a platform where some of Britain's biggest stars have the opportunity to reflect and celebrate their biggest professional accomplishments in a lovely, relaxed, chatty space. Since 2016, Josh Barry's Beyond the Title has celebrated the great and good of entertainment, from showbiz legends to rising stars and everyone in between, who have each provided an insight into their remarkable careers in the public eye. So join Josh and the team as another significant figure in entertainment shares their unique anecdotes and stories exclusively on Beyond the Title.
Beginning his career in 1958 as a Butlin's holiday camp entertainer, legendary comedian and actor Freddie Davis first found fame in 1964 on the heavyweight talent show Opportunity Knocks. A regular on ATV's flagship variety show Sunday Night at the London Palladium, Davies found himself at the epicenter of light entertainment and variety, and his rubbery pair of face made him stand out from his peers. From 1968 to 1971, the long-running British children's comic Buster featured the comic strip Freddy, Parrot-Faced Davis, based upon the adventures of Freddy and his Boogies. In 1974, he took the lead role in BBC children's television series The Small World of Samuel Tweet, before starring in the Disney movie Funny Bones some 20 years later. I caught up with one of the most versatile and enduring performers ever to grace British entertainment to talk legends, laughter, and his recollections on an incredible 60 years in show business. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Freddie Davis.
So, firstly, welcome to Beyond the Title, and it's such an honour for us to have you on, and please don't take this the wrong way, but the fullness of time has sadly robbed us of many of our best-loved entertainers. So as one of the survivors of this pioneering generation of entertainers, what sort of responsibility do you feel to keep this legacy alive?
How do I feel about it? Was that the question? Well, I suppose I'm thrilled to bits, really. It's, you know, you do what you do, I suppose. And thank God I've lived this long and I'm able to do something. You know, I've got lots of pals in the business, and a lot of them weren't doing very much, you know, particularly the older members. And we did the tribute show for Anita Harris last year in October. And there were, you know, a few of his old cronies got up there and did a bit, and it worked terribly well. So I said, well, why don't we see if we can sell it? So we put a few of the acts together, called it Legends of Variety. We're not legends, really, but you know, we're just older. and it came about. So there you go. We're doing the tour, and it's going very well.
Where are we going next?
Where are you going next?
We're in Darlington next week. That's our next date, which is the 20th at the Hippodrome, which is a lovely, warm, cuddly, old-fashioned Frank Matcham theatre. Just absolutely. And it's perfect for this show because, you know, this is a variety show. You know, it's what the theatre was. The theatre was originally a touring variety date. So it's wonderful, you know, to go back to an actual theatre called the Hippodrome. You can imagine, Josh, it's wonderful.
Are you coming down south on the south coast at all?
The nearest we get to, where are you, Josh? You're in.
We're on the Isle of Wight.
Oh, Christ, you're miles away, aren't you? No, we're not coming that far. An island's a bloody long way. No, the nearest we get to you, I suppose, is Poole in Dorset.
When's that one?
That is on the, I'll tell you exactly, said he, looking on his list. We're there on the 14th of September.
There we go. So, your route into entertainment was somewhat conventional compared to some of your contemporaries, like Les Dawson, in that you climbed the ranks in the holiday camp circuit. What sort of grounding did this give you, and were you a good redcoat?
An interesting question. Well, I never wanted to ever to do anything else than to go into show business. That was my whole, you know, being, really, from being a kid. You see, my granddad at the time was touring what was left of the music halls in variety between 1920 and 1950, I suppose. But that's when it sort of fizzled out variety theatres did, when television came in, of course, 1956. But so I never really wanted ever to do anything else. And so when I left, when I did my national service from 1956 to 1958, when I came out of national service, I went to Butlins and I became a redcoat. And I stayed there for 6 years. You know, really, that was my university training. That was my my way in, so to speak, because it gave me, you know, it was like, well, it was university, really. It was finding out how showbiz worked, because they had big theatres, they had small theatres, they had concert halls, they had bars you could work in. So it was always talking to an audience. And that is really, you know, part of the training, learning how to talk to an audience and really finding out what not to do, as well as what to do, what not to do. Yes.
So who else was in that, shall we say, class of Butlins when you were there? Were there any other big names during those?
Oh, yeah, years? Yeah. I mean, they weren't big names then. We were all starting together. I mean, Dave Allen was the actual, was a red coat, and he did a spot in the red coat show, which was nothing like he finished up performing. I mean, he was a zany comic in those days. He worked like Jerry Lewis. You know, he had a funny sort of a haircut, Dave, and we were pals from that day onwards, and we remained pals until, you know, till he died, bless him. But what happened with Dave was he went to America, no, sorry, went to Australia and became a bit of a name over there. He was like a talk show host. And, of course, when he came back here, he was once again unknown. But he used to do all the variety tours, you know, with the rock groups like the Beatles and, you know, the Rolling Stones. Because they, when they first started, they had to do variety theatres because there was none of these big old two places. So he used to do those variety bills with them at the top of the bill, you know, the Beatles at the top of the bill, and he'd do a spot in the first half. In fact, I went to see Dave when he first came back from Australia. He was appearing at the Odeon, Manchester. And I went round backstage to see it. And he was on the bill with the Beatles and several other groups. And because in those days, in the mid-60s, you never even thought that they were going to be famous, you know, the Beatles, as big as they became. But yeah, so Dave was my mate from the camps, and remained so for the rest of his life, of course. Yeah.
Would you say that Dave was more of an anti-comedian because he didn't really tell jokes?
Well, he did in the beginning. He did. I mean, he everything he did was based on a joke. You know, it was a sketch, which would be, you know, which is an elongated joke, really. But I think he prided himself in not being conventional, because he used to do all the stuff about coffins and vicars, and he used to take the mick out of the, you know, the Catholics, because that's how he was brought up. He was brought up in this very straight community in Ireland. In fact, he had a brother, Dave. It's called Johnny O'Mahony. His real name is O'Mahony. And he had a brother, John O'Mahony, who was actually, if I may say it, funnier than Dave in many ways. But he never, I think he succumbed to drugs in the end. But Johnny was a lot funnier than Dave. And they were both redcoats, different camps, but they were both redcoats at the same time. Yeah, I knew Johnny very well. Yeah, Johnny. He was a good lad, John. I like John. Yeah.
So who were your heroes on the variety circuit? Did you ever share a bill with a major international star?
Yes, I work with an awful lot of star names in the business. I mean, I worked with the Bachelors for years. I was with their agency, and I was always on their bills. I did two things happened. Once I did an American TV show with Dean Martin. I never met him, but they did this summer thing where they took the series that he normally did in the States. They sort of took it off for the summer, but they put a replacement in, and it was still the Dean Martin show, but he was remote. In other words, they recorded all these comedians all over the country, all over Britain, recorded them all, and then he just said, and here is another English comedian, Freddie Davis, and I was just one of those comics. But it was on the Dean Martin show in the States, although we never got to meet. It was, as I say, it was done remotely, and the recordings were taken back. I suppose the biggest name I ever actually worked with was Judy Garland. It was her final, didn't know it at the time, but it was her last TV ever in Britain, anywhere. And she was at the Talk of the Town, and she was doing a Sunday night at the Palladium. And I was way down the bill there, doing my little act. And at the end of the show, when we all stood on the roundabout thing, and went round on the roundabout, she was just, you know, one of six people standing there, this little lady who was, you know, revered in films, etc. And at the time, the press were crucifying, because she was at the Talk of the Town, and her career was in a bit of a state. But the press, whatever good she did in her acting and life and all those wonderful films, the press still vilified her. They were awful. I've never really forgiven for that, really. This huge star who they continued to hammer into the ground. I think they eventually killed her in the end. You know, the bad press. Very sad. Mm-hmm.
Didn't Jimmy Tarbuck host that show?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. I think we've got it on TV. It's on YouTube or somewhere. Yeah, Jimmy hosted it, all right. In fact, Jimmy had to go and fetch her from the hotel because she was at the Savoy. And Jimmy sort of knew her a bit because he'd been standing in for her at the Talk of the Town, because it was always an if it of whether she was going to appear or not. And he would be standing by on a sort of a nightly basis. So I think he sort of got to know her a bit. So they sent him for her to bring her to the theatre. And, I mean, the Savoy wasn't far away. Well, far enough away. But he did get her there, apparently. And we managed to get her on the stage. I mean, I watched from my dressing room because it was a live show. And I was watching on the TV in the dressing room. And they played her entire overture before she came on. She had this, like, 6-minute overture that they played. All her songs, you know, ding, 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 and the trolley and all those, you know. And they played this wonderful overture, which it didn't mean a thing on television because it was just music. Right, and they just took the camera all over the theatre, and then she walked on at the end to a tremendous applause. It was very sad, very sad.
So, just going back on an earlier question, looking back at the period of like the holiday camp circuit, what effect do you think that had on the story of light entertainment as a whole? And what do you think the showbiz landscape would have looked like without this style of entertainment?
Well, I mean, it came in about 1936, you know, the holiday camps. And when they took off after the war, talking about, you know, like late 40s, early 50s, when they started really to take off the holiday camp, it was a way of, you know, Britain coming out of the doldrums, really. And they did employ an awful lot of entertainers. They had a resident review show on the camp. They had a repertory company on the camp doing plays. They had two or three big dance bands, you know, two ballrooms with bands in. I mean, big dance bands, like 14, 15 piece. They had two theatre orchestras, one in the big theatre and one in the small, two variety theatre orchestras. They had I mean, really, it was a great place to be in the late 50s. I mean, I started there in 1958, and it was buzzing. I mean, the camp really was, you know, an entertainment complex. It was marvelous. I mean, what was wonderful about it, they had this amazing wet weather routine where if they saw a spot of rain, everyone was outside, they put the announcements out, all go to certain places like ballrooms and theatres, and there was always a wet weather programme where you would do a different type of show in the theatre. We get them inside. But that was a wonderful experience because, you know, I'd get called into the office and saying, you're on in 5 minutes in the Empire Theatre. And I said, doing what? He said, I don't know, make something up. Yeah, so eventually I did this little show. Don't ask me what I did, but it was, for some unknown reason, they called it Give That Man a Coconut. Don't ask me. Don't ask. And yeah, I know, it's hysterical, really. So it just meant nothing. We used to get people up out of the audience and ad lib. But it was great training, wonderful training. I was only 20. It was just wonderful experience, absolutely marvellous. But the question that you ask, which is interesting, is what mark did he have on British Showman? I think it had a great mark because people still talk about the Redcoats. I mean, there are still Redcoats in the camps that have been bought over and still run as Butlins. So, yes, it did have, I mean, a huge impact on British entertainment. I mean, the reason I got started was by asking Des O'Connor. He was in a variety show in Newcastle. And I asked him backstage, well, I was a stage door Johnny. I asked him how to get into show business. He said, do what I did, become a Redcoat. And I did exactly that. There you go.
So 1958, it turns out, was quite a significant year because you had Bruce Forsyth starting at the London Palladium, then people like yourself and Jimmy Tarbuck bursting onto the scene as well. Do you think there's anything special about that year? Like why it happened when it did, stars like yourselves?
Well, I mean, Jimmy Tarbuck really didn't burst onto the scene until 1963. I mean, he'd been a Redcoat with me at Butlins. He'd started at Brighton and he'd actually taken over from my... He used my bed. He went into my bedroom. It was the Ocean Hotel in Brighton. And they'd bought this house for the staff. Mainly the entertainers, and we all had a bedroom there. Anyway, he took over my bed, Jim, and he couldn't believe all the work we had to do. I said, that's what you have to do as a Redcoat. You've got to do the bingo, you've got to do introduce shows, you've got to do a spot, you've got to do all that, you know. Oh, he said, I'll never bloody do that, but he did. And he didn't last very long. I don't know what happened. I think he went to a camp, and he was a bit, what they would call a bit scouse in those days, a bit too Liverpudlian. And I think they got rid of him. Anyway, the next I heard about him was that he was doing Sunday Night at the Palladium. But it was 1963 when he did that first Sunday Night at the Palladium, yeah. But as I say, 58 was significant in as much as it was really my start in show business, just getting in. I mean, you know, one always says, how'd you get into show business? I don't think you get into it. I think you drift into it. You know, I just drifted, like most people in show. I mean, nowadays they have drama schools and but, you know, at the end of the day, you go to these auditions, you get you get drama school trained. I mean, I'd never heard of a drama school when I was starting. I mean, I didn't think I needed a drama school to tell jokes. But the drama school students actually don't really talk to an audience. They talk to one another, you know, as actors. So it's sort of a different discipline, you know, Josh. But my darling, I really do feel for you, you know, because it must be so tiring for you to have to, you know, to have to try and get your point over, you know, Josh. I really do feel for you, love. And how long did it take to manifest it? Can I ask you a question? Because I'm interested if you can answer it. How long did it take to manifest this awful thing that you've developed, you know, this?
It was at birth.
Pardon? At birth?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. So you're used to it now?
Yeah.
So what is it? Is it cerebral palsy or LMND?
It's cerebral palsy, yeah. Josh always says, he always tells people he had an accident that wasn't his fault.
Wasn't your fault, was it, either?
No, it wasn't.
He was just born like that.
No.
I don't want to address him. I want to talk to you because I know you. Because you can't address me properly, you think you can't hear me, and I know you can. You know, and it's odd, but
there are complications.
But lovely to talk to you. Onward and forward. Next question.
Yeah. So I've been lucky enough to stand on that famous stage at the London Palladium and look out to that vast auditorium. As an entertainer, why is this stage so special?
I think it's the history, you know. I mean, the Palladium was always the greatest variety theatre in the world, and it still is. Funnily enough, there's a similar sort of atmosphere on the Opera House Blackpool, which isn't as many seats, or just the Palladium hasn't got as many seats as the Opera House Blackpool where we were on Sunday with the show. But there's an intimacy about it when you're on stage. I can't explain it. You're quite close to the audience. You know, the front of the stage is quite close to the audience. And you feel as if they're, you know, they're very close to you. It's an odd feeling in a big theatre, but you know, you've got to get across that nerves field. There's a field of nerves when you go onto a big theatre, but it soon evaporates when you get that wonderful response back. You know, it's a great thrill. I mean, I did a month there with Cliff Richard, so I sort of got used to going on every night, which was fabulous, just to go on there every night and do your spot. You know, the audiences were just great. I mean, they're going there ready to be entertained. They're lovely. But what a thrill. I can't tell you, Josh. The thrill is unbelievable to come off there and hear that, you know, the roar of approval. It's just marvellous. Just wonderful.
So nowadays, reality television has totally revolutionised light entertainment, but in 1964 you auditioned for the heavyweight Opportunity Knocks. What sort of stigma was attached to these shows by other performers on the circuit, and in hindsight, how significant was this to the rest of your career?
Well, there's two questions, really. I think when it started, it was ever so slightly a bit amateur. I think they rushed it onto the screen. They'd had some kind of problem with Huey Green and they problem with the programme he was doing, and he never got to the air, but they still had him under contract. So they kind of rushed the programme onto the air. I mean, I was on programme 3 of the very first series, the third edition, and I think there were 10 or 12 in the first series episodes. So I was on the third one. What happened, I was in Scotland doing a summer show, which never quite happened. And when I say never quite happened, it was an open-air show. And I got there and I discovered it was me and a pianist. That was it, in his open-air show. And he sat there in his Mac playing the piano. and cloth cap because it rained all the time. I mean, the stage was covered, but the audience were all on. I mean, it was terrible. There was nobody in. So I stuck it for 2 weeks and I went home to Blackpool. I had a radio show to do. And I decided not to go back. Probably the only thing I've ever walked out on. And I remember I rang the promoter and I said, well, it wouldn't matter that I'm not back because I never go on anyway. It's always raining. So he said, well, if you don't do it, I'll have to. Because he'd promised to put entertainment into this little open-air venue for the council. So he had to do it. Anyway, I was gone. I was out of it. So I had no work. So my agent in Liverpool was just trying very hard to get me work. And one of the things he came up with was he said, why don't you go and see the producer of Opportunity Knox, a fellow called Peter Dooley. He's only down the road in Manchester. So I went down to see him. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say. I think they were really crying out for acts because he put me on that Saturday, that week, since I went down. And I had this, you know, the thing with the hat that you know. And because it was such a good sort of talking head, which is what TV, all that TV is, talking heads, it worked. And it was, you know, as I say, the rest is history. And it was because I'd walked out of a summer season, you know, simple as that. But so it had a significance, obviously, for the rest of my life, because that was the start of it. You know, I'd left Butland 10 months before, and all of a sudden I was on national television. It was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I didn't realise at the time how important it was. But, you know, when you think there's 20 million people watching you, even if half of them don't like you, right? Hopefully the other half will. And, you know, there you go. That's how it happened.
Huey Green remains one of the most influential and enigmatic figures in the history of light entertainment. What are your personal memories of him?
Well, he was always very kind to me and to the other acts. I mean, he loved the fact that he was helping other acts to get on. I mean, Dewey in the 20s, in the 30s and 40s, was a very big name in radio. I mean, he did Opportunity Knocked in Ireland, he did it in Canada. And he, you know, I mean, his real love actually was aeroplanes. He used to fly planes. I mean, he was a very good pilot. I mean, he could fly jetliners. And what he did during the war, you know, the 39-45 war, is Canada loaned their aircraft to the Brits. And he flew them all over. He used to go and fly a plane over and then go back on another flight and then fly another plane over. And that was really his job during the war. He was a war hero. But he wrote a lovely book, I think it was called Opportunity Knocked. And it's not to do with opportunity. It's to do with what he did during the war. And he was a very interesting man. But he also became a child actor. So he came up through films, did quite a lot of films, young Huey Green, and stayed, you know, and stayed acting and performing all his life. And one of the things he did was Opportunity Knocks on the radio, and he brought it to television. And he had a couple of big court cases. I think he won against Carol Levis and won against the BBC for using his idea. And he lost the case and lost a lot of money. I mean, it's all in the past now. It was all like in the 50s and 60s, you know. Or maybe. But it's an interesting story. Interesting story.
I like that joke that Bob Monkhouse does about Opportunity Knocks.
Which one's that?
He says
Yeah.
He rooms he
Oh God, it came on. All right. He said that there was always an old guy that would turn up to the auditions and then he'd turn around to him and say, "Go home, Des."
Typical Bob. Typical Bob. I knew Bob very well. He was a lovely man. That's a sweetheart. Very clever man. Very clever, you know, cabaret artist. Yeah.
The 1960s was an explosive era for culture with the rise of pop music, which influenced Bill Cotton and the BBC to create a new style of variety show, beginning with the Silla Show in 1968.
Yeah.
How important was this new strand of variety to offering performers of your generation another outlet for your talent?
Well, yeah, it was great because all these people were doing, you know, their own show, Tom Jones and Engelbert Humperdinck and Cilla Black. So, you know, they all booked us comedians because they really were the only guests they could. They could have singing guests, you know, but mainly they would have they would have comics. I mean, I was on with Cilla and I think Roy Hudd was on the same bill and Dudley Moore. It was a great bill. And it was the last of the series, the Cilla Black series, and she had a bit of a party. And at this party, Paul McCartney was there, and I met him for the first time. He was with Jane Asher. That's a few years ago. I mean, in fact, it was, I hate to say it, it was about 1967, 68. Yeah, going back a bit.
Hey.
The nickname Parrotface doesn't sound that complimentary. How did this come about?
Well, when I first started, Josh, I mean, I was doing the thing with the hat, you know, and calling the guy behind the counter Parrotface, because it was a derogatory remark, you know, to this guy. And, you know, in the old days of variety, you'd have, on a variety bill, you'd have your name, and then what they would call bill matter, which went underneath your name on the bill. So, like, my granddad's was like Yorkshire Wit, right? Or... you know, so and you would have an act that did a trapeze act, right? And you got Swinging for Joy underneath the name. So I needed a name. I thought that because in those days they didn't in when I first started didn't do photographs on the posters. It was just a name. So I thought, am I going to get this name? They probably won't know my name, but they might know what I do because I'd done a few TVs. So I just put the word Parrotface under the name. Freddie Davis, Parrotface. And I thought, oh, they'll know it's the guy that does Parrotface. What I didn't realise was that a certain printer decided to put Parrotface in the middle of the name. So it became Freddie Parrotface Davis. That was never planned, right? But it started to happen and I just let it go. I thought, well, at least they may know who I am now. So, but when I have a photograph on a poster, I take the Parrotface thing out. I just have Freddie Davis and my photograph in the middle of the poster. I'll see if I can show you an example of it, actually. Like this. I've got one here from, would you believe, from Blackpool. I don't know whether you can see that. Or is it back to front?
No, it's just gone blurry. If you lower it down a bit, I think if you bring it downwards, no, I don't think it's going to focus on it. That's okay.
No, that's it. I'm sure if it's like further. Oh, it's coming up a bit there.
Yeah, I think if you put it in front of your face. Yeah, there we go.
Oh, you see that? Yeah,
yeah. There we go.
Yeah,
I see that. Yeah.
Anyway, it's because I've got a blur on it, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
You see that there? So I've got the head in the middle there. Yeah. Anyway, that's it. Basically, that's how the Parrotface thing started. I mean, it was never intended. I mean, I never thought of calling myself, to be quite honest with you. That was the name I called a fella in the pet shop. You know, I say, hey, come here, Parrotface. But because it was a, you know, slightly derogatory remark. Well, probably a very derogatory remark to call somebody Parrotface. Because people used to think it was me. I looked like a parrot. And I said, I don't, do I?
So...
And,
Yes. So when Sunday Night at the Palladium closed its doors for the final time, there was a huge war between the TV networks as to which entertainers to sign on, mostly to front game shows. In your opinion, how pivotal a time was this for the preservation of light entertainment?
Well, it was very pivotal in as much as, you know, eventually they stopped doing light entertainment as we know it, as a variety show. See, when TV first came up with the BBC, all they did was variety shows because they were the only entertainers that were around that could actually go on, face a camera and do a spot, do a turn, do an entertainment. And then they phased it out because they got other forms of entertainment. You know, like you quite rightly say, quiz shows and the like. So I suppose they could phase out the variety shows as such. I mean, they still use the odd one, but I think it's changed so much now with the reality television, as you quite rightly said. I mean, which, you know, really, it's what we used to do is getting people up out of the audience, and that we call punters, and we'd get the punters up out of the audience because they didn't know how to behave on stage, right? And they would be the audience participants. We'd just say the participants of the audience because they wouldn't know, A, how to stand on a stage, how to behave on a stage, which is what we did naturally. So, you know, it really made them look like idiots, for want of a better word. So by using them in reality television, what they're making them look like is idiots. So all these programs you see, you know, with the man on the street, you know, like Four in a Bed or the cooking programs, I mean, you know, they try and make them look silly. Doing what they do, you know, make them into competitions, and they'll talk to one another and say, what did you think the bed was like? Well, I thought it was a bit lumpy. I mean, it's crap, really. You know,
in
do you know what I mean, Josh? It's not, is it entertaining? I don't think so. We sit and watch them and I turn them off. I mean, I can't be bothered with them, you know, they're just.
Yeah.
Take your time, love, don't worry.
It's cheap shit. Yeah, it's just cheap because if you take a show such as Love Island, they've got no overheads.
Yes, I suppose they have, really. But it is a cheat, really. You know, it's all a cheat, isn't it? It's all getting people to do, you know, stuff that, you know, as I say, you've got, you know, a lot of birds with big tits and fellas with muscles on, and it, you know, it suits a certain demographic. I've never seen it, to be quite honest with you. I've never watched it. I can't be doing it. To me, it's drivel. I don't find it entertaining. It's not. It's exposure, isn't it?
Yes.
You know.
I'm frightened that if I watch it, I might lose a brain cell.
You certainly won't gain one, I'll tell you.
So, in 1974, you secured a role in the children's series The Small World of Samuel Tweet. I was talking to the great Johnny Bull about the transition from a comedian to a children's presenter. In your opinion, what are the similarities between comedy and children's shows?
I mean, back in the day, we used to say kiddies show, children's shows wanted a lot of slapstick and stuff, you know, going on because they didn't have a big, great attention span. You know, they would sit at television, they'd run off and get a lollipop or run off and get a drink or something. So they didn't have a very big attention span. I mean, I never intended to be a children's entertainer, but kiddies loved the character. Because he was silly, you know, and they like silly little characters. And as Johnny Ball, I mean, Johnny and I actually started together also. I mean, he came to the Metropole in Blackpool when I was entertainment manager there, and he was a drummer. He played drums, so we had an organ and drum duo, and he was on drums. But he always wanted to be a comic, and so he set himself up as a comedian, went out on the road as a comedian. But then this opportunity came up for him to do play school. And he passed the audition because he could talk. He was a comic. He knew how to talk to a camera. And that's what he did. And that became his life then. And he did Think of a Number, and the rest is history. We're in constant contact, John and I. He's a great pal. But I think he wasn't so much as a children's entertainer. I think he became a bit of a teacher. You know, he did Think of a Number you know, he made a very, very interesting program for kids, and they loved it. And then he toured with it, and he's written dozens and dozens of books, which really go all over the world. So it's quite a phenomenal job, but it was quite a change of career for him, because he was, as I say, a comic on the clubs before he got this opportunity to do that. Yeah, interesting. So I based the series. Mine was different. It was about a silly little character in a pet shop, and with looking after the pets. So there was a certain amount of pathos in it, as well as hopefully some slapstick comedy. And that was a difference, really. Yes, but it was, you're quite right, Josh. It was a different to doing comedy for adults. And the problem with doing that was that, in a way, it sort of lost my adult audience a bit, because they classed me as a children's entertainer, which actually I wasn't. I was a comic doing children's entertainment, which is a different thing. I wasn't a children's entertainer. Now children's entertainers are prolific. I mean, they just do it to entertain children. They do a magic show or a clown show or just a show for kiddies. But they are children's entertainers. Yes, sir.
What are you doing? Hello?
Were you still doing the club circuit at the same time as doing
Yes. Well, I never stopped doing adult entertainment. You know, the series was on children's television. It was done at 5:15 on BBC One. So, I mean, there was such a thing that, and I know it's CBBC now, but there was such a thing as at 5 o'clock, there was a children's hour every day on BBC One. It's called Children's Hour. It came from radio, the title. But then, as it came to television, yeah, we did two series. We did 12 episodes of it. And then they decided it was crap. So they stopped it. I knew it was crap all the way along, but nobody would believe me.
So, more recently, you've starred in Disney's Funny Bones. What is the benefit of having that iconic name on your CV?
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, the film came from Peter Chelsom, who was lived in Blackpool with his mum and dad. And I knew his parents better than him, because they had a little shop in the Metropole Hotel, Blackpool. It was on the outside of the building, the Metropole. And they sold very nice antiques and stuff. And I often used to have a drink with them in the bar at the Metropole. And a few years later, Peter's mother asked me, is there any way I could find him a job in the business? So I gave him a little job in Ipswich in Panto, just literally as an ASM. But he had to come on one now and again and do a few lines and what have you. But it actually got him his equity card, because he then had a proper contract. So he got an equity card and he started to work in show business, and he went to drama school. But he decided he wanted to be a film director. And so when he qualified as an actor and did a bit of acting, and he got his first directorial job doing stuff, and then he did commercials and drifted into films. And because his first major film was Hear My Song, the Joseph Locke story. And with that, it was quite successful. With that, he managed to get the finance from Disney to make Funny Bones, which was really about old variety acts. And he'd he'd sat backstage in the Panto and listened to all the old pros telling all the old stories. And that's where it all came from. Yeah. It was great. It was great for me. It was a good film, and it became a bit of a cult classic, as you know, Josh. I think we've spoken about this before, haven't we? Yeah, yeah.
What's still the thrill of performing live?
Oh, there's nothing better. Nothing better. That's what we are, you see, comics, are live performers. Well, yeah, you know, you've got to get that reaction back. You've got to, you know, really, that's what we do. I mean, I still do it now. I mean, I go out on the Legends show and walk out on stage, and it's like the years have just drifted away. You see, all we've ever got in our life is our memories. We haven't got any future. We don't know what it's going to be, right? So we have our memories. And I think it brings back memories to the A, to the audiences, and, of course, to you also. I mean, although we are, I suppose you'd call us an old school show, we don't actually do old school material. We bring our material up to date. You know, I mean, I did the show on Sunday night in Blackpool. I mean, I still think my first gag was my funniest gag. I went and I said, I haven't been in Blackpool for many years. I said, a long time, in fact, very long time. I mean, can anybody tell me how long's that tower been there? See? Well, it was built in 1880, something like that. But I just think it's a funny question, really. How long's that tower been there? Like it was never there before I went. Anyway, that's me. But I remember, what's his name? Bradley Walsh. The first time I saw him in Blackpool, he was very funny. I don't know. Do you know? Have you been to Blackpool, Josh?
No.
He's not been. No. Well, they've got a very wide promenade. I mean, it's huge. I mean, really wide. You know, you could get 10 people abreast on it. And then they've got the trams that run along the front. So there's another distance. And then they've got a pavement, right? And then they've got a very short road, right, for the cars, two-way cars going past on the main road, on the promenade. So Bradley Walsh used to do this gag. He said, the trouble is you can't get over the road. He said, because if you come down the pier, right, and you get onto the promenade, you might get knocked over by a donkey. And if the donkey misses you, you get knocked down by a tram. And if the tram misses you, you get on the main road, you get knocked down by a car. You don't stand a chance. A funny gag, actually. Funny gag. Funny idea.
So, looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Oh, it's longevity. It's being here for so long. You know, all of a sudden you get to an age and you think, how did that happen? I mean, I know it's a modern expression, but how did that happen? How did all of a sudden I become 80? I have no idea. I had an 80th birthday party with a load of pals, which was great fun. And, I mean, I'm well beyond that now, but I suppose it's longevity, really, and just keeping going. But I think if you keep your brain going, like you have, Josh, I mean, really, that's marvellous. I mean, you've got a very, very quick brain, and it's wonderful to see. But I'm sure you get people to look at you and think, I bet you can't hear me and he doesn't know what the hell I'm saying. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you.
So,
I come.
You're disagreeing with me now, aren't you?
I come.
So Josh has got another question for you, and it's a bit of a difficult one to answer, so bear with.
When would you tell the warrior your skin, and how would you come?
So it's a hard one, but when would you say your generation of variety sort of ended, and how would you sum it up?
Well, I don't think it didn't just end. I think it drifted away. I think people just got... It just drifted away. You see, basically, show business is really in the hands of people who run it, right? So there were agents who booked variety acts, and they eventually faded away. They died, whatever. The old variety acts that used to be all died or didn't get work anymore or couldn't work or weren't able to work. So I think variety just died. You know, and I think one of the biggest factors was television, of course. Television killed it, right? I mean, the films in the 30s and 40s sort of took people away from variety theatres as such, but quite a lot of shows they used to do called cine variety, where there would be a film, then a few acts, and then a film, and that would be the entertainment. And they did build cine variety theatres. In fact, there is one still operating. Not necessarily a cine variety, but it's called The Plaza in Stockport. And it was built as a cine variety theatre in the 30s, about 1934, something like that. And they have an organ in the front, and the organ comes up and does half an hour. Then they have a film, then they would have, you know, variety acts. I mean, they do variety nights now, so because it's a lovely theatre. We're doing it in September, but it just is the most gorgeous theatre to play. So I think... When it died, you know, at the advent of television, you know, after the coronation in 1953 and people started to buy tellies, you know, by 1960, you know, it had sort of got rid of the old variety theatres. There was still a circuit of theatres in Britain doing variety. You know, the bigger ones, you know, like the I think there was the Empire, Plymouth, and a few hippodromes left. But they were doing what they call number one variety. You know, there'd be American stars that would come over and do a show, a tour, and they would put British variety stars with them, the ones that were left, right? And Des O'Connor was on one of those bills that I saw touring in 1956. It was, yeah, no, but not by 1957 it was. He was... You know, the end of the variety era. So they didn't call us variety artists when I was there. You know, they would just call... We initially were called front cloth comics because we stood in front of a cloth like this and we told our jokes. So they were, and that eventually became stand-up because the comics were standing up telling jokes. That's where it all comes from, stand-up. But as I say, I remember myself as being called a front cloth comic, and which is what they were, of course. So I would say it was television that really killed it. In the end, killed the old variety theatres. Well, you won't remember that. You're too young. You must have read about it, though, have you?
But you still had variety on TV up until the 70s.
Yes, it was, yeah. Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. But it was absolutely right. But they would probably be, you know, featuring big TV stars, you know, like Val Dunican and dare I say, Rolf Harris. I mean, they were all big but they were actually TV stars as such. I mean, yes, there may be recording stars as well. But they were basically TV stars, but they got chances to do summer season and pantomimes, etc. And bred a new. There was a new breed of comics and variety. What I would call variety turns coming through in those days. But a lot of them had come from the old variety circuits. You know, Val Dunican was an act. I think it was the Four Ramblers, four singers. You know, with guitars and stuff. And then Des, of course, started in variety in the early 50s. And went on and was a red coat, etc. So, you know, they all came from that variety circuit. But you're quite right. There was a bit of variety still left on television in the 70s. That's quite right. I'm going to have to sneeze.
Yeah. Oh. Bless you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
So, just to finish off then, what's next for Freddie Davis?
Well, I'm still doing the tour, this Legends of Variety tour, which will go on until the end of September. And then it's anybody's guess, because I've sort of been semi-retired for years. I have to bring my book up to date, which is now 10 years out of date, so I've got to do that before it's reprinted. So I've got stuff to do, you know. I've got stuff to do, bits and bobs. And I currently act on television, so I get the odd thing on TV. When I was in that recent thing, The Thief and His Canoe, you remember that one? It was on the repeated. Did you see that, Josh?
I think it was very good.
But I only had a little bit in it. But it was nice to be in. And I don't seem to have any time. I always seem to, you know, take my time up. I keep myself busy, keep my brain going. Try to, anyway. Because once that stops, you stop, as you well know.
Yeah, thank you for your time today, and that is a perfect way to end, I think.
Bless your heart. Josh, it's been a joy talking to you.
Thank you very much to our wonderful guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title episode. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else you like? We're now on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. Everywhere, quite frankly. Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews, and please do give this podcast a little share. Not in a shoop-shoop song kind of way, you understand, although that's probably quite welcome. Thanks again. Hopefully see you next time. From all of us here, goodbye.